Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Labor wins a case with a Mexican auto parts maker in early tests of the new NAFTA. Agriculture workers dying in the heat. A GoFundMe page had to be set up to pay for the guy's funeral. And today on the show, the exploitation of warehouse workers. And we talk about changes at the National Labor Relations Board. Welcome to the Friday, August 13th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. John Lippert is going to be our first guest on the show. He is co-author of a heck of an article called The Warehouse Archipelago. As many as 4 million workers labor in clusters of warehouses scattered all around the country. Many are mislabeled as temporary workers. Every one of them poorly paid, and there's a lot of on-the-job injuries. A little background on John. He started writing about cars when he was about 20 years of age. We're going back to 1973, and he was working at the Fisher Body Plant in northeastern Ohio, Elyria, Ohio. He bounced around General Motors for about 8 more years, and after that, he decided to leave making cars and study journalism. Along the way, he became a senior writer and bureau chief at Bloomberg News, a labor writer at the Detroit Free Press, and a bargaining chairman at the newspaper guild, Local 22. He now lives in Chicago. He's still writing, and as I indicated, he's a contributing writer to the American Prospect. Prospect.org is her website. It's a heck of a story. He uses the name Rebecca Wells in the story. It's not her real name. He just wanted to protect her from warehouse managers and staffing agencies who often blackball workers who dare to speak out. And some people have been speaking out to him anonymously. And we're going to talk about these workers working in very profitable warehouses connected to very profitable corporations like Mars Candy. That's right. Since its founding in 1911, the company, we're talking about Mars, generated $137 billion for their founding family members who still control the company, according to Bloomberg. Now, the way it works out, Mars doesn't run the warehouse. They have a temporary staffing company called Staffmark, which in turn has been hired by another company. I mean, you follow me on this? It's kind of confusing. But that's what's going on in America, so people can be isolated from anything that happens at those warehouses. And we'll get into the details on that, because a lot of people are getting injured. Very little unionization when they try to unionize. And you know what happens. I mean, look at Amazon. Perfect example there in Bessemer, Alabama. Speaking of which, we're going to get into that later in the show with the return of Joyce Goldstein. Joyce joined the show a couple of years ago, and she had a couple of months off. And I'm not at liberty to explain why she took some time off, but eventually she will explain. It's a really interesting story. But she's going to talk about the changes at the National Labor Relations Board, which happened pretty much when she was gone from the show. And now we have a pro-union labor board. Now, getting back to Amazon, Amazon may see another vote at that Bessemer, Alabama facility because one of the members of the labor board issued a report. We talked about this on the show a couple weeks back, recommending a new vote because Amazon tainted the mail-in election, which ended in April. A couple things that happened there. They spoiled the process for a fair election. The company, first off, distributed vote no paraphernalia to workers in front of supervisors, which may have been coercive. And this is the big part. They pressured the U.S. Postal Service to place a mailbox at the warehouse for the election. The election was done through mail ballots because of the pandemic. And a lot of people were scratching their heads saying, why is there a mailbox over there? And Amazon had access to unloading the ballots. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. So Joyce is going to mix all of that up as our second guest. Got to give her a plug here. It's Joyce Goldstein and Associates. She represents public and private unions, fringe benefit funds, employees, construction, industrial service, and professional sectors. Just Google Joyce Goldstein. You'll get a lot of information on her. The U.S. government and Tridonix, which is a Mexican auto parts maker, have come to an agreement to improve working conditions at their plant. This is big news. The enforcement comes as an early test of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, USMCA, the new NAFTA. The company will now provide severance and back pay to at least 154 workers who were fired and will support employees' rights to determine union representation without coercion. The AFL-CIO lodged a complaint about 3 months ago, and labor has long complained that substandard labor conditions south of the border keep salaries down and cause unfair competition with U.S. workers. An example of such labor repression occurred in the same case last year when a trade union lawyer was jailed. Why? Because she tried to organize workers at the plant. She was only released after agreeing to internal exile to another Mexican state and accepting a ban on appearing in labor court. Crazy things in Mexico. Record temperatures, as you know, sweeping the country, and agriculture workers are paying the price. The United Farm Workers has tracked at least 3 heat-related deaths this season. One analyst noted the dynamics at play, writing that compared to the meatpacking industry, hired farm workers are just as vulnerable, if not more. Roughly half lack legal immigration status, and the labor-intensive jobs they do yield little pay and meager benefits. Most don't even have access to adequate health care. Many don't speak English. For example, Adrian Aguirre died traveling in a company van that had no air conditioning or windows. Guetta Vargas collapsed on the job at a hops farm. His daughter wrote, "No one deserves to pass away at work." And she wrote that on a GoFundMe page trying to raise money for his funeral. They just don't have enough to bury him. There are currently no OSHA rules covering heat stress, and lacking many traditional labor protections, agriculture workers face steep challenges improving their working conditions. We mentioned this on the show when the Pacific Northwest was undergoing a heat wave, and at least one worker died. I believe it was in Oregon. It might have been Oregon or Washington State. But the bottom line is, it came to light then that OSHA didn't have any standards when it came to heat exhaustion, and they're working on it. But we won't know anything until at least October, when it won't be hot anymore. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, who has, in the name of freedom, been locked into a lethal competition with the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, in recent weeks to see which state can boast the greatest number of residents infected with the coronavirus, has called an extraordinary special session of the legislature to, according to the Texas Tribune, make it harder for workers in the state to obtain paid sick leave. How about that? In the middle of a pandemic, the governor added an item to the agenda calling for legislation shielding private employers and employees from political subdivision rules, regulations, ordinances, and other actions that conflict with federal or state law relating to any form of employment leave. In other words, if you sort through the gobbledygook there, the item is an attempt to preempt local labor laws, which has been going on all over the country, especially mandatory paid sick leave. Right now, more than 4 million workers in Texas lack access to paid sick leave, which obviously is crucial to mitigating the spread of COVID-19. Just can't figure out these governors. All right. I want to take you back to the AFL-CIO webpage. As you know, Rich Trumka, the president of the Labor Federation, passed away last Thursday, August 5th, when he was on a vacation with his family. He is going to essentially lie in state tomorrow for 5 hours in the House of Labor, the Federation building in Washington, which is located at 815 Black Lives Matter Plaza. It's open to the public 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. On the AFL-CIO page, there's a slew of comments from people who worked with Rich Trumka over the years. Yesterday, we played a clip from Senator Sherrod Brown. And now I want to play a clip from Senator Elizabeth Warren out of Massachusetts, who was really, really taken back by the death of Rich Trumka. Let's listen here on the show.
Rich was real. He was a third-generation coal miner who rose to become the president of the United Mine Workers and the president of the American Federation of Labor. Rich was also a hunter, and he had the patience of a hunter. The planning, the long hours, sometimes long days, but always on his target. And Rich was a fighter. He was relentless. When Rich got in a fight, Rich never gave up. Might not win every one of those fights, at least not the first time out, but he never gave up. From his growl to his laughter, Rich was real all the way through. He lived his heart every single day. He was always Rich. Back during the financial crash in 2008, 2009, and we were trying to build an idea for a consumer agency to make sure that people wouldn't get cheated next time around the way they had been. And what led up to that crash, Rich was there. And he was there because he had seen firsthand what it's like. He had seen his brothers and sisters in the labor movement who had lost their homes, who'd lost their jobs, who'd seen their pensions disappear because a handful of greedy banks and feckless regulators had permitted the rich and powerful to take over our government and to take over our economy. And they brought that economy to its knees. It fell hard on working people, and Rich was determined that would not happen again. I remember the day when President Obama announced that they were ready to lay out the first outlines of what the financial response should look like, what kind of laws we should pass here in Congress in order to make sure that this didn't come again. There were a bunch of folks who were invited to the White House. I was invited. It was like my first time there. I'm looking around. Wow. And a bunch of people crowded in, and all cared about was hand us the list. I want to see what's on it. Is there a consumer agency on this? And we get in our assigned seats, and I sit on these tiny little chairs jammed together so they can get as many people as possible. And Rich, who was a man of considerable size, is sitting directly behind me, kind of mashed up against the back of my chair, leaning out, and we're on the aisle, both of us. And we're furiously going through it to see what's there. And sure enough, the White House has said there's going to be a consumer agency, or at least that's what they're going to ask for. So I'm smiling. I turned around and I said, you see this? And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, it makes me a little nervous for you to be right behind me here. And he leaned over and he whispered in my ear and he said, I'll always have your back, Elizabeth. And I reached back and patted him on the leg. And it was true. I never got in a fight for working people that Rich Trumka wasn't already there. that he was already in that fight, that he already saw what was happening to working people on the ground and what it was that we needed our government to do by way of response. Rich fought for decades for working people. It was his true north. He never varied from that. He never wanted anything for himself. All he wanted to do was to see workers get more power so that they were playing on a level playing field, to see workers be able to work in safe conditions, to see workers get a chance to build some real security for themselves and for their families. Rich measured everything that came his way against that test. What's it going to do for working people? And if you could show him this is going to help working people, Rich was in it all the way. During COVID-19, Rich was here back and forth and back and forth trying to push this government to get more worker safety in place, more regulations that were going to protect people so people weren't out there dying trying to do their jobs. Rich was there trying to protect the economic security of workers, people who'd been laid off, people who'd been shut out of the workplace. It was Rich who helped lead the charge. Watch out for working families. He didn't need the glory, he didn't need the spotlight, but boy, he was in there pushing in the way that only Rich Trumka could do it. Rich understood that when we put workers at the center of our policies, then families win. When we put workers at the center of our policies, then our economy wins. When we put workers at the center of our policies, then our nation wins. That's how Rich lived, and that's how Rich died. To Rich's family, I am so sorry for your loss. For Rich's brothers and sisters in the labor movement, I am so sorry for your loss. Rich is gone, and that is a hard blow to you and to our whole nation. And this is the moment to honor Rich's legacy, not just with words, but by staying in the fights that Rich led us on, by staying in the fights relentlessly for workers' rights. We're going to miss Rich.
Again, Senator Elizabeth Warren from the state of Massachusetts on the passing of Rich Trumka 1 week ago, last Thursday, when he was on a vacation with his family. Again, there will be a public service tomorrow at the House of Labor in Washington from 10 to 3 p.m. You could find more at AFL-CIO.org. Quick break. When we come back, the plight of warehouse workers in America.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation, will be joining us next Tuesday. Right now, let's go to line number one and welcome John Lippert to the show. John's got an interesting history. He was born in Toledo, Ohio. He moved around, worked at GM, and then he got into journalism. And I saw his name a couple of days ago in an article in the American Prospect. Great publication, prospect.org. A lot of good progressive information there. And he co-authored an article with Stephen Franklin. And we're going to get into that. It's about the plight of warehouse workers, many of them temporary workers in America. So, John Lippert, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ed.
So, talk to me about your background here. 1973 is a year, almost 50 years ago. You were working at, what, the Fisher Body Plant in Elyria, Ohio? Talk to me about that part of your life, John.
Well, I guess you would say I was a college dropout. So, I mean, I went to Oberlin, which is right near Elyria. I went there a couple of years, and, you know, I couldn't afford it, I guess you would say. So I went to GM first as a summer job in Elyria. That was a great job to have. So I made foam seats. You know, we did everything in-house at GM at that time. And I moved parts around, but then we got, you know, when I hired in, they said, you're 20 years old, you know, get your 90 days in and then you'll retire when you're 50. And that's what we all thought. But then right then came the, you know, Yom Kippur War. Remember the Arab oil embargo?
Uh-huh.
So immediate layoffs. And so then I started bouncing around. And, you know, finally I got a job up in Detroit at GM at the Fleetwood, you know, Fleetwood Fisher Body. I worked there, bounced around some more. And finally, you know, my wife said, this is ridiculous because of all the layoffs, and go back to college. And that's what I did. So then I worked for the Detroit Free Press. I worked for Bloomberg News. And now I'm retired but still trying to write. And, you know, very happy to work with Steve Franklin, as you said, for the American Prospect. So that, I guess that's sort of my life story, I guess you would say.
Yeah, I'll tell you, and you got into the newspaper industry, and that's changed dramatically as well compared to the auto industry. Hey, talk to me about your union involvement. You were chair of, what is it, Newspaper Guild Local 22. Was that in Detroit?
Yeah, the Free Press. I mean, I was, under duress, I guess you would say, but we had a strike at the Free Press and the news in 1995, and I was, you know, I was chairman of the guild for a while at the Free Press, and we were on strike. I mean, it went on for years, and it's pretty gruesome. Eventually, the unions got back and slowly sort of rebuilt themselves. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, at the time, we said that, you know, I mean, this was a full-blown, you know, barbed wire and, you know, Vance guards and the whole thing. And we always said that would never happen in Detroit, couldn't happen in Detroit. But, you know, the newspapers never stopped publishing. So,
yeah,
I mean, so that was quite an experience.
Oh, I bet it was. Well, let's talk about your article here that you did with Steve Franklin, The Warehouse Archipelago. And apparently there's a lot of workers, 4 million of them. They work in warehouses all around the country, and many are mislabeled as temporary workers. And worker misclassification is a huge issue in America. But you have a story here about, and this is not her real name, Rebecca Wells. Talk to me about Rebecca Wells, because this is a woman who's struggling to make a living, and she's having a very difficult time. I'll let you pick it up from there, John.
Well, I think the visual image is, remember the famous Lucille Ball in the chocolate factory, right? She was trying to keep up with the little pieces of chocolate rolling down the line, and finally it kept going faster and faster, so she would start eating the chocolate and stuffing it in her bra, and So Rebecca, she worked at a Mars candy. They call it a warehouse. I mean, part of what they do is pack. So her job was to stand behind this machine. 9-pound bags would come out every 6 seconds, or smaller bags even faster. And her job was to pack them and in a box, and then feed the box into a tape machine. But sometimes smaller bags would come out faster. The size of the box would vary, and so every box was different. And then sometimes she would just fill half or a third, and then two or three of her coworkers would do the rest. And these are bags full of like Twix and Skittles and Mars bars, all the things we all grew up with.
Sure.
But one of the things that was difficult for Rebecca was, she's African American and speaks English, and some of the people around her were immigrants, Spanish only, and so communication was a real problem, and including when COVID came. So, they're right next to each other, chasing these boxes with a pandemic, and they can't even really talk to each other about how to deal with that. So that's just one example of sort of, I guess the main point we're trying to make is, like in Chicago, I wrote a story for the Better Government Association in Chicago here. Amazon built like 40 warehouses over the last, 4 or 5 years in the Chicago region. And the way we talk about it in Chicago is, thank God somebody's willing to invest, and thank God they're going to build these warehouses. And one of the things Amazon did was, pressure these local towns, and so they got $741 million of tax breaks. And everybody talks about it as if, okay, well, we lost the steel industry, we lost auto, but at least we got Amazon,
Yeah.
And they use the word industrial, and they say, well, this is an industrial facility, but it's really not. It's a warehouse. It's different, and it doesn't, and it isn't intended to be sort of this path to the middle class the way we used to think about GM. I mean, it's just a completely different animal, and that's what we're trying to say. We use the word archipelago, right? But, there's a system of these things, and it's working the way it's intended to work, which is, find people like Rebecca and, put her in this temporary job and sort of leave her there. And that's, and except then there's also a huge turnover. And so that's sort of the nature of the system, to just turn people through. And that's what we're writing about.
And we're talking about a company that can afford, much like Amazon, to pay their workers more. We're talking Mars Candy. And I was reading in your article how profitable they are. Since its founding in 1911, the company has generated $137 billion for its founding family members, all who still control the company. And they don't actually run the warehouse, don't they? They farm that out. Let's get into that part. Now, they farm that out to another company, which farms it out to another company. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, that's so the building in, we're talking about Joliet, Illinois, which is about 40 miles southwest of Chicago. So Mars has a big warehouse there, 500 people, but almost nobody works for Mars. So the first what Mars does is hire the a logistics provider, they call it. So in this case, there were two XPO and DHL, which are both huge companies in themselves, and then the logistics provider would hire temporary agencies, and there would be several of them. And actually, one of the difficult questions about trying to write a story like this is just to keep track of who works for who and who,
right,
who made what decision. And then one of the companies will say, "Well, that wasn't me. That that was a temporary provider." So it gets pretty murky, actually. But So Rebecca, who we're talking about, worked for a temporary staffing agency called Staffmark. And that was true of a lot. And it's often the case that, if I'm working next to you, you might work for a different staffing agency and may have different wages and different everything. So, there's just layers and layers of this sort of thing.
And with that being said, John, it gets complicated when people get injured on the job. It's like, oh, well, it's not my responsibility to take care of him or her. You know what, John? Let's hold that thought, because I want to talk about not just what's happening in Chicago, but what's happening in America. I mean, there's a lot of workers that are being exploited, and it's because they're labeled as temporary workers. And when they try to unionize, they get shut down. We saw what happened in Bessemer, Alabama, with Amazon. John Lippert joining us on our live line, and we'll continue the conversation with him. Great article. Just check the American Prospect, prospect.org. Joyce Goldstein will be joining us. Boy, she hasn't been here since the last 4 months, and she's been on a special assignment. But she's going to get into all the changes that have happened in the last couple of months with the National Labor Relations Board. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at KellyAndFerraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, we're available on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. When you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We'd appreciate a 5-star rating. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, celebrating 50 years. And you can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin John Lippert. John is co-author of an article, The Warehouse Archipelago. How do you pronounce that, actually? You said archipelago. Is that right?
Well, that's the way I pronounce it. I mean, I don't know. There's probably an English professor on listening who'll call me up, but that's the way I understand it.
Well, when I was growing up, it was Hiroshima. Then I heard it was Hiroshima. So, I mean, everything changes over time. But anyway, I want to get back to your article here, which is fascinating. We're talking 4 million workers in the country, and they're, most of them anyway, are mislabeled as temporary workers. But I want to go back, and John, you have a history here. I mean, you started at GM. You saw the decline of the middle class. You saw the decline of unions in America. Mm. And you point out in your article, and this needs to be said, that warehouse work, and we're seeing a lot of warehouse work. Everybody's buying packages from Amazon, and it's all coming from China. The manufacturing jobs that were here in America have gone to China, and those boxes are coming over here with products made in China, and the warehouse industry has exploded. But there was a time in America where many of those warehouses were unionized. Talk to me about that part. What's happened here?
Well, let's just stick with Mars. I mean, Mars is a company that was founded in Chicago in the 20s, I think. And they had warehouses in or next to Chicago. And, you know, the people who worked there were employees of Mars, and they were unionized. But then, you know, 70s, 80s, you know, and accelerating from there, then Mars moved sort of 20, 30 miles to the west. And when they went there, and then at the same time, companies like Walmart and them were opening up out there. And so, as this, it was a geographical shift, but then the company said, you know, the unions are going to stay behind. We're, you know, so the buildings they opened were non-union. And there were, you know, there were fights, but, you know, the established unions, you know, the Teamsters and them, I mean, they were not able to keep up as a, and it's exactly what happened in Detroit as all the auto parts plants used to be in the city of Detroit. They all used to be unionized, but then they, in the 50s, they just started moving them all right down 75 all the way to, Tennessee and Alabama. And those auto parts were never unionized again. So that's what happened. But then there's another thing is when Mars had what they called the warehouse in the 60s, in Chicago, it played a different function. So, in other words, there would be, you know, 100 stores very close to that warehouse, and they would store candy, you know, and try to predict what demand would be. But they would store candy for regional distribution. But now, what we call a warehouse, there, as you said, I mean, if you use manufacturing, but all this stuff is coming from Chicago, I mean, coming from China, and then it reaches a warehouse in Joliet, Illinois. It's not there for local delivery to like the Sears and Roebuck, which are all right. But instead, they unpack these containers and put everything on a truck, and it's within hours, it's on its way to Milwaukee or, you know, Minneapolis or Cleveland. So it's a distribution function. It's not manufacturing in the sense that we used to think about it, and it's also not even storage. It's just movement. It's racing through there, and that's what the function of what we call warehousing is today. So it's a completely different animal.
And John, according to your article, a lot of people that work in the warehouse industry, I mean, first of all, the pay is horrible. I believe I saw one salary at like $12.81 an hour. How do you feed a family on a wage like that? And there's got to be injuries on the job. When somebody gets injured and they're on, you know, they're working for a temporary staffing agency, what happens to them in a case like that?
Well, it's you know, we have a couple of examples in the story, but I mean, people, like one woman lost her leg, and she got, I think it was, After several years, she got a settlement of like a couple hundred thousand, and I mean, she says, I mean, this is not enough for me to live on, and she lost a leg. So, I mean, I think the best way I can think about it now is, I mean, we talked to Rebecca and people like her, but also the movie No Man Land. I thought that was fabulous, Frances McDormand. But here's an older woman, her husband died, and the town faded away, and she, you know, sort of, she's very unsettled in her life, and she's bouncing around the country in her van, right? That's why they call it No Man Land. But almost anywhere she goes, she can stop for a few months and work at Amazon. And, you know, that's fine with Amazon because they're not really trying to get people to stay anyway. And so she wants to come and go. That's okay. And then hopefully somewhere along the line she'll get her life, you know, back together. You know, and for some people, I mean, they're in these warehouses we're talking about, there will be, you know, college students that come down from Chicago on the weekend, and you know they're doing that to finish their degree.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of people that are not upwardly mobile in that sense, and in some ways the system is designed to prevent upward mobility. Like one example, we talked to Mark Valentine from Warehouse Workers for Justice in Joliet, but he said, you know, people with, you know, they call it paper, but ex-convict, you know, but if you're on paper, well, the only people that are going to hire you are the temp agencies. And then, so then you work at the same job for 2-3 years and you say, okay, well, I want to, you know, have a permanent job instead of temporary. And then they'll say, well, sorry, you're an ex-con. And then this is, you know, when they're getting tax incentives to hire people coming out of prison, right? So it's,
yeah.
So in some ways, the system is designed to prevent upward mobility.
Yeah, I think we call it the hollowing out of America. It's really sad, but that's what America has become over the course of time. John, we're just about out of time here. John Lippert, who co-authored the article with Stephen Franklin, The Warehouse Archipelago, and it's in the American Prospect, prospect.org. Thanks for your contributions. Hang in there, my friend. Hopefully things will get better. Maybe we'll pass the PRO Act so more people could unionize in America and stop this madness, okay?
All right, well, let's keep talking, and I appreciate it.
Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up next, Joyce Goldstein talking about the changes at the National Labor Relations Board.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you are exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly and Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly and Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And of course, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number two right now and welcome back to the show, Joyce Goldstein. Joyce joined us on the show about a year and a half ago, and she's taken a couple of months off, and she'll explain why she took off in a couple of months. She's not at liberty to do that right now, and she's here to talk about some changes at the National Labor Relations Board, and there are many since she's been gone. Hey, Joyce, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us once again.
Hey, Flash. It's great to be back. Thank you.
We should And we should point out that Joyce Goldstein and Associates represents public and private unions, fringe benefit funds, employees in construction, industrial, service, and professional sectors. Website is joycegoldsteinlaw.com. Well, I tell you, this Biden administration is going at lightning speed, making some very pro-worker decisions. I want you to pick it up from there, because the National Labor Relations Board under Biden is a different animal than when it was under Donald Trump. Talk to me about that part, Joyce.
Well, sure. There have been a lot of changes over the last few months, and particularly since the end of July. So really, even only in the last few weeks, that have, as we talked about a lot over in previous shows, we talked about the significance of the general counsel at the NLRB, who's kind of the top prosecutor and, you know, who really directs a lot of the policy of the agency. And as you recall, we talked a lot about Peter Robb, who had held that position during the Trump board years. When President Biden came in on his first day of office, he removed Peter Robb as general counsel, which was a pretty bold and controversial move. He put then a temporary person in, an interim person, Peter Orr, who was the regional director in Chicago, but then nominated Jennifer Abruzzo. And Jennifer was just confirmed by the Senate at the end of July, and she is now the new general counsel. So that's a really big deal. Jennifer had been at the NLRB for about 23 years. She had been the deputy general counsel under Dick Griffin during the Obama term. And then she left at the end of 2017, went to work for the communications workers as special counsel. And she's now back at the agency. And she is off to a really big start. So that's exciting.
So, Joyce, I understand that she's kind of issued a memo as kind of like her game plan moving forward at the NLRB. What's her plans there? What do we know about it right now?
Yes. So what typically happens when a new general counsel comes in is in the very early part of their tenure, they issue a memorandum that kind of sets out what their priorities are. And the way that they do it is they say these are the things on these subject areas. If these matters come up within the regions around the country, if on these subjects, they say send those cases to Washington, to the general counsel's office, to a particular division of advice within the general counsel's office, so they can take a look at it. And so that's a way of, you know, corralling the kinds of cases and subjects that the general counsel thinks are important. And so what she did was yesterday came out with her memorandum that identifies the issues that she really cares about. And she divided into three different areas. And the first were cases or subjects that were recently overruled by the Trump board. So a lot of the things that we've talked about on this show are those where the Trump board had overruled existing precedent. And she wants to go back and take a look at those and evaluate whether she wants to try to have the law changed and modified in some way, or keep it, or what to do about it. And in that area, she had listed out 11 different subjects that she wants to take a look at. Those are all subjects that the Trump board had overruled existing precedent. So those were the handbook cases, ones that involved confidentiality provisions and separation agreements, right line, which is the standard for when people are disciplined or discharged because of union activity, access to work sites, which is a big issue in organizing cases. She wants to look at the remedies, union dues, the kind of agency security issues that we think of as those Beck cases, jurisdiction over religious institutions, and on. So as I say, there are 11 areas where the Trump board overruled existing precedent, and she wants to take a look at those. But she also, she didn't stop there. She has a second area of cases that are subjects that she wants to take a look at. And those are not ones that necessarily were recently touched upon, but some are kind of longstanding issues that she said that, you know, she also wants to look at. And those involve issues like employee status, you know, who's an independent contractor, who's an employee covered under the act. She wants to look at Weingarten, which is the right to have representation in investigatory interviews that could lead to discipline. And there the issue's been back and forth many times over the years about whether that protection is afforded to non-union workers. She wants to look at the right to strike and picket. So she's got, you know, a pretty long list in that second area. And then her third area is just procedural issues, which are, those are fairly typical, are the kinds of things that that the regions often send to the Division of Advice within her office. So it's a big list of subjects that she's going to be looking at, and I think that pretty well people expect that she'll bring the policies back into line so that they'll be more consistent with what the fundamental purpose of our federal labor laws are, which are to protect workers' rights. And obviously that's not what we had seen over the years of the Trump board when Peter Robb was a general counsel who believed that apparently that his role was to ensure that employer rights were protected and not worker rights. So I think we're going to see a big change there.
Oh, a huge change there. Wow. What you laid out is enormous. That's one to watch, no doubt about that. Let me ask you this real quick. Now, when she picks and chooses, like, you know, what Trump overruled or changed when he had his people at the NLRB, does she have to go to the rest of the board in order to get agreement on those issues if they want to reverse them? Or can she do that single-handedly?
No, of course she has to go to the board because, again, she is only the prosecutor. So what she can do is she can tee up those cases so that the board itself could take a look at them. She doesn't change the policies. She is the prosecutor who presents the opportunity for the board itself to change the policy. But gotcha. The board, I mean, that's, yeah. So there are changes that are going on with the board also. Because, of course, the board, as we've talked about, is a 5-member board. And over the last number of years, we have often not had a full board. So there have been times that there's been a 2-member board. That is no longer the case. And that's the other big area of change since the Biden administration. And again, in the last few weeks, because initially, well, when Biden came in, we had one Democratic member of the board, of the 5-member board, and that was Lauren McFerrin. And so he made her the board chair. So that was the initial change. And then we've had a vacancy on the board since August of 2018 that had been Mark Pierce, the former chair's position, who I know you've talked with before on your show. So Mark's been gone for 3 years, and that's been a vacancy for 3 years. And President Biden nominated Gwen Wilcox, who is the first Black woman ever to sit on the NLRB. And she had been a union lawyer from New York, represented SEIU 1199. So Gwen was nominated and confirmed by the Senate at the end of July, July 29th. So she is now on the board. And also, interestingly, there's one more position which isn't even yet vacant, and that will become vacant at the end of August. That was Bill Emanuel, who is the Republican. When his term's up, he will be replaced by Dave Prouty, who's now already been confirmed by the Senate to a vacancy that doesn't even yet exist. And Dave Prouty also is a union lawyer. So what will happen in the next couple of weeks is we will, for the first time in years, have a full 5-member board with a Democratic majority of 3 out of those 5.
Wow. Big changes at the National Labor Relations Board. Well, I tell you, Joyce, you put it all together for us. I really appreciate you coming back to the show and sharing all that information. And also more to come because there should be a decision soon if there's going to be another vote at the Amazon facility in Bessemer, Alabama, because one of the members of the labor board said she thinks there should be a vote, and I guess that will be a decision that will be made up by other board members in the next coming weeks. Joyce, a pleasure having you back. Joyce Goldstein and Associates, joycegoldsteinlaw.com is the website. You take care, and we'll talk to you next month, okay?
All right. Thanks, Flash. Be well.
That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, the Communication Workers of America and the News Guild. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.